I'm Mike Hudak, Director of Public Lands Without Livestock and author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. For information about my book, please see the website, westernturfwars.com. Ranching on public lands of the American West is typically criticized on the basis of two factors: harm caused to natural resources, including wildlife, and economic subsidies. In this podcast, I propose that a third approach take precedence in a broad-based effort to persuade the public that such ranching is undeserving of their support. That third approach is based on the philosophical concept of aesthetics. But before examining this approach in detail, let's look at the standard arguments against public lands ranching. In any case, they should be kept close at hand in our educational efforts. First, ranching harms wildlife by damaging habitat. More than 150 wildlife species are federally listed as threatened or endangered, are candidates for listing, or are proposed for listing, at least in part, for this reason. Then there's the government's Wildlife Services Agency, which typically responds with lethal force to even the possibility that a coyote or other predator might attack livestock. Every year, tens of thousands of animals are shot, trapped, or poisoned by this federal agency and its state counterparts. Public lands ranching is also criticized for the high taxpayer subsidy it receives, especially when that subsidy is viewed against the small amount of beef that this ranching produces, the relatively small number of ranchers who benefit from the subsidy, and the meager economic contribution that this ranching provides to most of the rural communities in which it operates. According to a 2005 report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, grazing programs operated by the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, receive an annual subsidy of almost $115 million. And this is just for the direct costs of managing the grazing programs. Indirect costs, which have not been calculated by the government, are estimated to be much greater. In a 2002 report titled "Assessing the Full Cost of the Federal Grazing Program," independent researchers estimated that $280 million of these agencies' annual budgets would be unnecessary if ranching did not occur on federal public lands. And even this figure may be too low, as officials from the National Public Lands Grazing Campaign, citing the same data, estimated the subsidy at $330 million. Combining these direct and indirect costs brings the total annual subsidy of federal public lands ranching above $450 million. And what do these subsidies produce? A very small amount of beef, about 2% of the national total, based on the BLM and Forest Service lands yielding about that percentage of the nation's livestock feed. And how many ranchers benefit from the subsidies? About 26,300. That's less than 1.5% of ranchers in the United States. And even in the 11 western states, only about 12% of the ranchers hold federal grazing permits. Finally, there's the economic contribution that federal public lands ranching makes to the West. University of Montana economics professor Thomas Michael Power estimated that across the 11 western states, only 0.7% of the jobs and 0.4% of the income are derived from ranching on federal public lands. A finer-grained analysis of the regional economic contribution attributed to public lands ranching can be found in Power's study of 7 states in the Columbia River Basin. There, of 102 counties, only 11 had more than 1% of total income or employment resulting from public lands ranching. These, then, have been the major complaints leveled against public lands ranching in recent times. But as I stated at the beginning of this podcast, there are other significant objections we can raise. And here's one of them, that ranching diminishes our aesthetic experience of nature. Here I'll turn to philosophy rather than to ecology or economics. Specifically, I'll draw upon the field of study known in the 18th century as aesthetics of nature. Nowadays, it's typically called environmental aesthetics. My remarks will be based on information found in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, to which I direct the listener who desires more details. As the encyclopedia notes, the field known as the aesthetics of nature was founded on the concept of disinterestedness, by which is meant that the aesthetic appreciation of nature is disassociated from the appreciator's particular personal, religious, economic, or utilitarian interests. Disinterestedness, then, provides the basis for understanding the aesthetic dimensions of nature in terms of 3 distinct conceptualizations. The first is that of the beautiful, sometimes applied to objects small and smooth, but subtly varied, delicate and fair in color. it may well apply to a tamed and cultivated garden or landscape. The second conceptualization is that of the sublime. Entities so described include those experienced as powerful, vast, terrifying, and definitionless. Mountains and wilderness are typical examples. And third, there is the conceptualization of the picturesque, which typically holds the middle ground between those aspects of nature experienced as either sublime or beautiful. During the past two centuries, philosophers have broadened our understanding of environmental aesthetics to include notions drawn from the emerging field of ecology, as well as from developmental and environmental psychology. But for the purposes of this podcast, the concepts of beauty, the sublime, and the picturesque will be sufficient to provide a cursory analysis of writings and sayings about what ranching has done, and continues to do, to nature in the American West. I'll begin our tour of aesthetics in nature with a few passages by the 19th century American naturalist John Muir. In his book, The Mountains of California, Muir passionately wrote about his encounters on public lands with herds of domestic sheep. Muir wrote, "Returning from the glaciers shortly afterward, my worst fears were realized. A trail had been made down the mountainside from the north, and all the gardens and meadows were destroyed by a horde of hoofed locusts, as if swept by a fire. The money changers were in the temple." In this passage, Muir broadens his aesthetic palette by characterizing a natural landscape in terms of a domestic one with which his readers may be more familiar, and by choosing words that suggest the concept of beauty, as well as the picturesque. Going beyond aesthetics, Muir invokes religious symbolism to not so subtly inform the reader of his opinion about the presence of domestic sheep on this landscape, and what should be their fate. Elsewhere in the same book, Muir describes in more detail the consequences to the landscape of bringing domestic sheep to the Sierra. I quote, "Incredible numbers of sheep are driven to the mountain pastures every summer, and their course is ever marked by desolation. Every wild garden is trodden down. The shrubs are stripped of leaves as if devoured by locusts, and the woods are burned. Running fires are set everywhere, with a view to clearing the ground of prostrate trunks, to facilitate the movements of the flocks and improve the pastures. The entire forest belt is thus swept and devastated from one extremity of the range to the other, and, with the exception of the resinous Pinus contorta, Sequoia suffers most of all. Indians burn off the underbrush in certain localities to facilitate deer hunting. Mountaineers and lumbermen carelessly allow their campfires to run. But the fires of the sheepmen, or muttoneers, form more than 90% of all destructive fires that range the Sierra forests." Observe Muir's choice of words and phrases that suggest a brutal tyranny. Words such as driven, trodden down, devoured, running fires, devastated. And all of it tied to the domestic sheep and their masters, the muttoneers. There's no agonizing here over the values of the sheepmen that conflict with his own. No mention of their economic concerns, nor those of the communities in which they reside. Nor mention of the food and fiber that the sheepmen might claim are necessary to feed and clothe the nation. Muir's values are clear, and in the Sierra at least, he is for wilderness. And much of the way he expresses that view is through an appeal to the aesthetic sensibilities of his readers. I turn now to observations about ranching that occurs on public lands in our time. The speakers are people who I interviewed for my book Western Turf Wars, and their comments, like those of John Muir, have a decidedly aesthetic quality to them. Steve Johnson, a former public school biology teacher and representative of the environmental group Defenders of Wildlife, has lived in the American West since the mid-1940s. His remarks remind us that there's a difference between seeing and perceiving, and that without the latter, there may not be much of an aesthetic response. Here's what he said. "Being outside, watching, seeing the evidence of cattle, it was just kind of a background. The cattle shit was everywhere. I just assumed, never thinking about it, that we must produce a lot of cattle on Western public lands because I saw so many signs of the cattle, if not the cattle themselves. It took me a long time to realize that really very little was produced in terms of beef by the cattle that I saw. And yet I was increasingly aware of damage done by the cattle to everything that, to me, was most important. That is, the natural settings, the plants, the native wildlife. It took a long time, though, because I was never conscious of it as an issue until I began to really look at it." Steve Johnson, like John Muir, speaks of damage to the landscape. damage that nearly everyone would regard as diminishing one's aesthetic experience of nature. Who except perhaps a rancher would call a landscape beautiful that is covered in cattle excrement? Another person with specialized training with whom I spoke is Leon Fager, a retired 20-year veteran of the U.S. Forest Service. In our interview, he spoke about a favorite place in Arizona. There are a few areas in this region that haven't been grazed by livestock for 50 years or more. Large areas. Many thousands of acres, in fact. One is called the Three Bar Wildlife Area on the Tonto National Forest. Hasn't been grazed since 1943. And where it has not been grazed, you're waist-deep in desert shrubs, grasses, and other plants. Each canyon has a little spring or seep in it. Consequently, there's lots of plants and animals that rely upon those habitats. South of the boundary fence, it's strictly bare desert, and what we call in the West, creosote bush. Some people call it greasewood. And it's absolutely unpalatable for anything except the one lizard that survives on it. Other than that, there's no vegetation out there. It's gone. It's gone to livestock. Unlike John Muir, Fager, along with all of our contemporary commentators, avoids religious metaphors, perhaps an indication that religion today less permeates our culture. But like Muir, Fager draws upon universally understood concepts of human existence. He associates the absence of livestock with intuitive notions of ecosystem health, abundant vegetation, presumably native, and water, which is essential to life. He notes that where cattle roam, the landscape is impoverished. Only weeds and a lone species of lizard survive. And Fager emphasizes the point that humans have chosen the loss of water and vegetation in return for cattle production. Of that water and vegetation, he laments, it's gone. It's gone to livestock. Another of my interviewees, like Fager, focused on what has been lost because of ranching. But Charmaine Whiteface of the Oglala Sioux Tribe of the Great Sioux Nation emphasized the loss of wildlife in her remarks. There were wolves in this area, where we live in western South Dakota. There were bears. There were a lot more bobcats. There were a lot more predators than there are now. Where are the wolves? They're gone. Where are the bears? They're not here anymore either. Where is the buffalo? Where are all the different kind of grasses? Where's the tall grass prairie? Even at the time of my great-grandfather, there was still tall grass prairie. Grasses that were taller than his horse. Grasses, of course, that would be taller than me if I stood up. Where are they? Through her series of rhetorical questions, Whiteface paints an impoverished landscape that even the most biologically uninformed person can appreciate, and most likely feel badly about. Here we have the loss, certainly of the picturesque, maybe even of the sublime. Patrick Deal, another of my interviewees, initially learned most of what he knew about ranching's impacts by reading Lynn Jacobs' book Waste of the West. Several years later, when Deal moved to southern Utah, he had the opportunity to view these impacts within the newly established Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Here Deal gives his personal account of hiking in the monument on the Kaiparowitz Plateau. Incredible views from up there, and no roads. North of this section of the Kaiparowitz are a series of deep canyons that have eroded all the way back to the Straight Cliffs Rim on the west. So to get a road in, you'd have to drop down into a series of canyons and climb out again, over and over. There's no town there. There's only been wild country and then sheep and cattle. So it's not only an unroaded place. It's a place that feels like it will never have roads. To me, it was very exciting because there are really very few places left in the West that you can day hike into that don't have roads in them. So it could have been a wonderful natural area. But instead, what we found when we went up there in June of 2000 was this cow-beaten, thoroughly trashed place. Arroyo bottoms had no riparian vegetation, only a trickle of water. Cow trails going up and down. The springs were beaten into a mire. It must have been a wonderful place 100 years ago. And now, kind of the bones are still there. You're still 3,000 feet in the air, and there are canyons in the top of the plateau. And all these wonderful views. And there are places where there is some vegetation, like oak brush, and it feels really wild. But if you look at the detail, you can see the terrible impact of public lands grazing on these allotments. And so, like Johnson, Fager, and Whiteface, Patrick Deal highlights what has been lost to ranching, here speaking of it in the metaphorical background as the flesh on a body. After 100 years of ranching, only the bones remain. Deal, much like John Muir before him, then went on to speak in more detail about the devastation wrought by livestock upon the landscape. The bottom of the canyon is a moist meadow that looks a lot like a golf fairway. The reason the meadow looks like that is not just that it's grassy. It's because cows mow the grass down. And even after the cattle removals, this continued to be the case. In 2001, some of the springs had stopped running. But this one was still running. So the cows were coming there big time, the trespass cattle on the Griffin allotment. They were hammering the spring there. You could see the aspen dying along the north-facing edges of the moist meadow, which is the last place you'll find aspens as you go down in elevation. And there are other places up there where you can see the same thing happening. There are no young aspen. The cows have been in there and trashed the spring near the aspen. And they're not going to reproduce themselves with the cows up there. In at least one respect, Deal's account of a region damaged by cattle rivals that of our previous speakers. Here, not only has vegetation died, not only are specific plants in the process of dying, but even the possibility of the vegetation's reproduction has been rendered impossible by the actions of cattle. Broadly speaking, we have the gruesome image of not just the dead, but also the dying and the castrated. Julian Hatch, like Patrick Deal, is a resident of southern Utah who possesses an intimate knowledge of the land that's now encompassed by the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Although this region is not officially designated as wilderness, much of it certainly has a wilderness quality, which Hatch cited in his description of ranching on the monument. I have to mention the latest thing that we've seen the last couple years. They look like half of 50-gallon drums. They're yellow plastic, and they've got supplemental feed in them. It's like molasses mixed with other nutrients, like vitamins for cows. We're seeing the winter allotments having these all over the place. And of course, the cows stand around and lick them until they're empty. Then you see those plastic barrels blowing around out in the wilderness. The point of this is that the cows lick these nutrients out of these barrels, and then they can just eat sagebrush. They have the nutrients, and they have something in their stomach to keep them going through the winter. It's like they could eat cardboard and lick these nutrients and do fine. That's how bad it is. These animals are actually starving to death out on the landscape. In Hatch's characterization, not only have cattle made the landscape uninhabitable by native wildlife, but it has become virtually uninhabitable even by cattle. Only human intervention now allows them to survive there. And as a consequence, the picturesque nature of the landscape has been further diminished by the sight of plastic barrels blowing in the wind. I'll conclude this podcast with remarks made to me by Stephen Herman, an ecologist and retired member of the faculty at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. It was his remarks that inspired me to more deeply examine the application of aesthetics to the effects of ranching on public lands. By way of further introduction, I'll note that Herman's reference to Heart Mountain is to the wildlife refuge of that name located in southern Oregon. Here's what Herman had to say. As I get older, I'm much more concerned with beauty than I am with data, and I feel that we should elevate our argument to include a consideration of the aesthetics of landscapes. It's my understanding that there's something in the National Environmental Policy Act that would be receptive to that approach. When I was at a workshop on Heart Mountain, in the run-up to the removal of the cows, when all stakeholders were present, a guy named Doc Hatfield, a rather loquacious Oregon rancher, kind of took over the opposition. He got up and said to all of us, "Tell me, what do you want here? What is it you want?" And I said, "A cow-free landscape." "Oh, no, Steve. What is it you really want?" I said, "A cow-free landscape." And he couldn't deal with that. So I think that it would be useful to experiment with looking at that level of argument. That's much of what we do with our slideshows anyway. Certainly bare ground, that's deleterious to some wildlife. What we're showing for the most part is damage to landscapes. Visual damage. Aesthetic damage. It's just a waste of all that beauty to deface it with cows or sheep. Herman's remarks capture the essence of our topic. So I'll only comment further by citing the text in the National Environmental Policy Act to which he referred. Section 101, paragraph B, subparagraph 2 of the Act, states in part that it is the continuing responsibility of the federal government to use all practicable means to improve and coordinate federal plans, functions, programs, and resources, to the end that the nation may assure for all Americans aesthetically pleasing surroundings. If only the federal government would actually enforce that provision.